This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 83 of What's It Like. My guest is Judd Valesky. Hey, Judd.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You're somewhere in Colorado.
Yes, out in Boulder, Colorado. We're just 30, 40 minutes north of Denver.
Did you grow up in that area?
I did. My family moved here in 1979, and grew up here, me and my brother, mom, dad, elementary school, high school, actually went to college here as well, University of Colorado at Boulder, studied computer science and political science, graduated from there, moved out to Silicon Valley for 3.5-4 years, and then came back to Boulder in late 1999 to start my family.
Oh, how fun. When you were growing up, who had the biggest influence on your life?
My father, certainly, always there and had a pretty significant stake in raising me, so certainly a ton of influence. Another individual that had a lot of influence was, and this sounds corny now, was actually Anthony Robbins, somewhat infamous kind of self-help guru type.
Mm-hmm. Tony Robbins?
Yeah, Tony Robbins. He went to elementary school with his daughter and got to know her growing up, and that kind of crossed over into digesting what he had to say and his outlook on life and how to approach life and so on. And I took that bait. I read his books and listened to his material, and that certainly influenced a lot of my approach to things.
Well, you had a personal connection. That did that help you understand the books better?
Yeah, no question. I think without that, I probably would have just dropped it in the bucket of, too obscure, too esoteric to really get involved with. But yeah, being able to see his world literally and his daughter's world, I knew there was nothing strange going on. So it was accessible in that manner.
What was your major challenge as a child?
Major challenge as a child, fitting in. I was just having this conversation with some friends over dinner last night. My friends have some kids, have a child, I have some kids, and we were talking about parent-teacher conferences and what we probe for when we do those. And anyway, we were having this conversation just last night, as it turns out, and I was probably a fairly classic case of did not fit the mold, from a school system standpoint, and that was very hard on me, excruciatingly hard on my parents, we battled with that for quite some time until I was able to push out into the world as an adult, and there's an interesting transition that happens there. You go from needing to conform almost completely to being spat out into the world and, being on your own, and you get to find everything the way you want it defined. There's still lines you have to color within, but you've got a lot more room. So I was looking forward to that transition, and when it came, was quite happy.
Was school hard for you?
The mechanics of it, no. The material, education, no. The way it was presented, the structure around it, yeah, for sure.
Is there a childhood experience in particular that you think that contributed most to who you are today?
I don't know if it's the one that affected me the most or, you know, necessarily in what way, but in elementary school, my mother raised us to never hit anyone, right? You never punch someone. And I took that very literally, too literally in retrospect. I was certainly picked on a fair amount in elementary school, and I'm sure some of it was well within the normal bounds of going through elementary school. But then, there's sure a particular bully constantly in my business, I every time there was a confrontation, I would take to heart I'm not going to hit this guy. And in retrospect, I'm actually not sure that was the right thing, and I'm not sure that's actually what my mother was trying to convey. I think there are circumstances in which you need to punch someone, and one of them is if you're punched. I think there's a defensive component there where you should feel free to flail back. And I even think there are some circumstances in which throwing the first punch makes some sense. And in retrospect, looking back on that dynamic, I wish I had thrown a first punch. And I think that would have eliminated many months of various bits and parts of elementary school where I was, dealing with that bullying component.
Did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
No. I didn't, it was never anything conscious at all, in fact. Looking back, I definitely had those tendencies for a significant portion of my life. I can think back to, I was probably 8 or 9 years old when I started a tiny little kid's leather shop business, right? And in school, somewhere along the way, there was a class where we tooled leather and we engraved leather and made bracelets or wallets or what have you. And I converted that into a little door-to-door business in my suburban neighborhood with a friend. And So early on had that tendency. I certainly didn't know what entrepreneurialism was at the time or what it meant to be an entrepreneur, but that component was certainly there. And throughout junior high and high school and college, I always had one business or another running.
So what exactly do you do?
So right now I'm CEO of a company in Boulder, Colorado. It's called GNIP, G-N-I-P, GNIP. It's Ping spelled backwards. our business is all about disseminating real-time social activities across the network, from social networks such as Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Flickr, etc., to our customers who in turn take that data and analyze it and divine marketing signal, trading signal, disaster relief signal out of that social consciousness. And we're generally characterized as an enterprise business where, our customers are all enterprises. They're other businesses. They're not individuals. And it's another way to characterize it is it's a fairly low level plumbing, technical infrastructure, software play. It's all about message routing and efficiencies and high volumes of data being communicated in a highly reliable, high volume manner.
Hmm. So if I was a company, I would come to you and say, I want to track my company name or a particular theme or any of the above?
All of the above. Yeah. There are generally two categories of product. There's one that we call volume, and a volume product is where you just want randomly sampled, statistically significant quantities of social content streamed to you in real time. And that use case is more along the lines of, I want to analyze what other people are saying and understand what's popular. And then we have coverage products that are more narrowly defined. You are interested in a very strict set of keywords or companies or brands or concepts, and you tailor the stream of information to precisely what it is you're interested in.
Hmm. How did you decide to go into this business?
Oh, interesting question. I had just left another company, and I was kind of engineer in residencing out of one of our investors' offices now. It's a company called Foundry Group, a venture capitalist firm. And coincidentally, another entrepreneur was transitioning out of their current situation, and we had a guy by the name of Brad Feld as a friend in common. And Brad thought, interesting. Let me put these two in a room together, and one can provide a business perspective, one can provide a technical perspective, and let's see what happens. So Brad Feld kind of pulled us together, and we had great rapport, saw eye to eye with respect to social media becoming a significant part of the puzzle in the software industry, and wanted to make that efficient. We wanted to make the consumption of social content easier, more efficient, more prolific, and we started getting it 4 years ago, almost to the day.
What's the best thing about your job?
I believe what's unfolding in front of humanity with respect to online social digital consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg, and this collective ambient intimacy that's taking place on social networks across the globe is just starting. And this company, Gnip, is at the forefront, or at the nexus of that, whatever the cliche is. But I get to see that every day. I get to see my customers. I get to have a call with, multiple times a day with another entrepreneur who has a brilliant idea around how to tap into this online social consciousness and extract value. And, that can be commercial value. It can be social good value. There are so many different ways of looking at it, and Gnip has taken a position in the space that allows it to span all of that, as opposed to having to pick a specific vertical and only understand that to infinite depths. We're very broad and we're very wide, and seeing all the different ideas that we fuel is kind of miraculous from my perspective. We just get to see all these different configurations and all these different thoughts with respect to how people want to engage with this data. And that keeps things fresh and interesting every day. There's always some new dynamic every day that's fun.
What's the worst thing about your job?
Hard decisions every day.
Mm.
They never let up, and they probably only ever increase by the day. And while there's a rush to that, you know, having to make hard decisions in a moment and having all eyes on you. You know, there's an adrenaline rush component of that. There's also a, you know, a serious stress component of that. And, you know, managing that is hard. And in this job in particular, it's quite difficult.
Well, what type of person would be good at your job?
You know, I'd given this some thought a few months ago. The New York, it might have been a cover story in a Sunday Times, New York Times issue. I can't remember exactly the hypothesis, but it was counterintuitive. It was I'm going to get it wrong, but it was something akin to, you know, ADD types actually fit well into executive roles, and the profile they were trying to build was, you know, here was someone stumbled throughout life, didn't fit, lots of missteps. I think clinically diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, whatever the term is these days, and finally found success and peace in an executive position. You know, I don't know exactly what the role was, but consider it something akin to a CEO. And you know, this person believed they had found their groove, right? And I thought that was interesting, and it validated some thoughts I had not been able to put into words or put structure around. But I think there was something to that notion. You know, I think there's absolutely an ADD component of this job. I mean, in a lot of ways, it just defines it. And if you can't go from topic A to topic B in an instant, and in a very deep manner, you'll be in a lot of trouble. You know, this job is anything but consistent. And when you try to, you know, there are times when I'll seek that. I will seek consistency, and the job inevitably kicks me back out of that notion. You know, it's, you know, no, you cannot have 6 hours of time to yourself, or, you know, 6 hours of working on a single project. It's just not practical. And so if your psyche is such that you require that, I don't think that roles like this are good for you. If your psyche is such that you're wired that way, you can skip from A to B to C to X to Y to Z and back again in a 60-minute period, you know, then I think you've got a shot. And then if you can apply an enjoyment to that, then you've got something, right? If you've got the skill and you enjoy it, or if you have the inclination, the ability, and and you enjoy it, I think that's a pretty good combo for something like this.
So mildly ADD. Medication not required?
I don't know. perhaps medication required as well.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day for you?
There are two of them. There's a typical day when I'm in Boulder, and there's a typical day when I'm on the road. Typical day when I'm in Boulder, I'm always the first one up in the house. Get up. If I'm lucky, I'm up at least 5 minutes before everyone else, and I can get a cup of tea going. Then I make breakfast for the kids, get them fed, hand off to my wife, who then gets them the rest of the way to the car. I drive them to school or bike. We often take our bikes to school. And then I, you know, I'm in the office around 8 a.m. And then usually, you know, 30 minutes to collect my thoughts and things and put out any email fires. And then the day starts with working with my coworkers and solving problems. Inevitably, there's at least one kind of panic or fire drill in the day that bubbles up and starts pushing the schedule around. Tons of collaboration all day long. Generally not a moment alone during the workday for sure. Get home 6 o'clock, give or take, 30 minutes generally. Spend time with my crew at home, my kids, and play and read and homework and such, and then dinner. And often, after the kids go down, I've got some other event or meeting that runs an hour and a half from drinking, going and getting a drink with a coworker or a client that's in town or a partner that's in town or what have you. That's a typical kind of when I'm in Boulder day, when I'm quote unquote home day. On the road, my clock is permanently wired to Boulder, Colorado mountain time. So no matter where I am, I wake up at, 6:30, 7 a.m. mountain. And if I'm on the, west coast, that I get an extra hour, is how I look at that. If I'm on the east coast, I'm in a panicked rush because I've started my east coast fast day late. And that's always a challenge. West coast, I can always
just schedule for afternoons.
Exactly. Yes. But then, yeah, when I'm on the road, it's, it's similar. The family component is not, operationally there. Usually a lot of running around town between taxi cabs or rental cars or, what have you. And then wind down in the evening, usually, evening, dinner meetings as well, push on the road, really try to make that as efficient as possible and interact with as many people as possible. So that's usually wall to wall until bedtime.
So everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Two things come to mind. And I was having this conversation about a year ago with one of our board members, and it's less about how, it's more about when do I know to do that. I have a bit of an inverse view of, how I interpret what's going on around me. So when I am sending positive signals about, say, the business, if it's overly positive and overly zealous, you should heed that as a warning that there may be something wrong. And then the inverse of that, if I'm down and out and concerned, very good odds we're at a peak and we're actually riding really high. I was trying to, me and this individual were having some communication issues and I realized that was the issue, and I was trying to explain this to him. And so I've learned to key in on that myself. So when I start riding a little too high, I use that as an internal signal to, okay, well, kick in the pants time. That probably means it's time for, a charge of some sort. And, what do I do to do that? It generally comes in some kind of physical form, around activity. You know, and that may be a particularly long, hard bike ride, or a longer stint, a longer run of things. You know, this month I'm going to make a push to run more or bike more or ski more, what have you. But it generally comes in that form, a physical form. And what I've identified over my life for sure, unequivocally, physical activity, i.e. exercise, i.e. more oxygen in the system, translates directly to motivation, translates directly to productivity, clarity. And so I reach for something physical in that manner. And that, you know, 9 times out of 10 is the charge or the focus or the you know, the motivator I was after.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Two things. One of them's the same. The physical activity is very soothing. It's soothing in the moment when my bones and muscles are in pain. It's soothing afterward for 24 to 36 hours. But then I also tap, yoga is very soothing to me, some meditation. And then I've got a pretty reasonable, body work addiction. So, actual massage, you know, deep tissue, massage, Thai massage. That's relaxation in a very literal sense.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yeah, two. One physical, one mental. Two come to mind. One physical, one mental. Physical, a few years ago, I rode my first mountain bike race. And I had no idea what that was ultimately going to mean, despite having spent months training. It was roughly a 2-hour mountain bike ride. I was in the beginner's class, so it wasn't, you know, expert or professional, but nonetheless, roughly 2-hour ride. And I looked down at my bike computer when I had reached the point of true physical exhaustion, and the bike computer told me I was about 20 minutes into the ride. And it was a moment of, you know, okay, I actually think I'm out of gas, but I've got an hour and 40 more minutes to go. What do I do? You know, it wasn't, you know, an hour long ride and at 55 minutes I got tired. It was, you know, it was completely out of whack. I finished the race. I certainly didn't place very well, although better than I was expecting. I probably came in maybe halfway in the pack. But that I had to dig on a physical level. I did not realize I could dig to, in that moment. And then kind of the more mental, emotional dig piece, was about, let me get my dates right here. 18 months ago or so, my co-founder at this company, Ganip, moved on. We had turned into a business that wasn't what he had set out to build, and he just, his passion was elsewhere. He left, and I was left with the decision of, you know, do we fold this thing up, or do I completely grab the reins? I was in a I was CTO prior, and he was my co-founder was CEO, and so I was faced with the question of, you know, do I want to try my hand at driving the ship? And I opted to do so, and you know, to this day, that challenges me to the core. For the first 48 hours of that, it was similar to that bike race. I had no idea, how far down the rabbit hole actually went, and I was experiencing it in the moment, and learning, being tested, and learning things with no trial, with no test period. Right? It's you're in the moment, and you make the right decisions or you don't, and you push through it or you don't. So those two moments come to mind.
Is there an idea or a principle that helps you through your challenges?
Yeah, probably cliche and corny, but my children do. About 6 years ago, I left a lucrative, cushy, stress-free position at a large company. That to any most outsiders looking in, it made no sense to make that leap to jump, but I did on my own recognizance. And the motivation around that was my children. It was my kids, and I was fast forwarding. My son had just been born a couple of years prior, and I was fast-forwarding, imagining, talking to him as a kid, as a youth, as an adult, about life, and inevitably, of course, hey, what does Daddy do? Would be a topic of conversation, and I wanted to have the right, what I believe to be the right or a good answer, and that answer was not, Daddy travels once a month, gets paid a lot of money, but doesn't actually do much. I knew that was a bad answer. That was not an example I wanted to set. I wanted to, I knew what I was going to be loading my kids with for the foreseeable future was persevere, work hard, do things that push your boundaries, take risk, et cetera, et cetera. And I was doing none of those things. And that just felt very hypocritical. I didn't want to be lying to my kids, obviously. I wanted to be speaking from truth. And that motivates me all the time, every day, throughout the day. I in one form or another, discreetly or indirectly, need to convey my actions to my children over time. And, when a hard decision has to be made, I want to be able to explain to them the process I went through to make that decision, how we arrived at that, in the face, of adversity or against all odds, how did you do that, Dad? And I want to have a meaningful answer there.
If you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
This is a topic du jour here amongst me and a handful of other folks in Boulder. It's rooted in risk, unfortunately, in those two formats, high school and college / university, more and more, I'm thinking that's not the right framework. So there would be a threat of break out of that mold, break out of that framework, and go push boundaries on your own. The curriculum, the mold that has roughly been constructed is actually not a valid one anymore. And in lieu of having a valid one in front of you, I would highly recommend going constructing one on your own. Take ideas you have and try to bring them to fruition, whether they're social change, whether they're commercial, business oriented, what have you. Kind of define your own path. I think you'll be better off leaving a lot of the existing framework behind.
Well, it's difficult to be a doctor without going to medical school. So is this more for entrepreneurs, or are you thinking more generally?
I am thinking more general. There are certainly professions or skills that need intense, long durations of training, education, etc. Doctor is an easy one, although I would argue that model is even, riddled with very significant issues. And I've got personal 1 degree of separation experience with that, with others in my family who mowed their way through, 8 years of medical school, popped out the other end, top of class, saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, had issues starting up their own practices, right? Decade-long saga of, why that model has got plenty of issues. That said, that's an obvious one where you've got to have a baseline. So even if you clean out a lot of the issues, sure, there are professions that need that. But no, more generally speaking, beyond just that, I think that today's knowledge worker roles or creative roles, a lot of that is around direct, and potentially most or all of it is around hands-on in the system experience, and much less of a academic theoretical model that needs to be applied. And obviously, I do think there's a general thread here. I'm certainly biased and can empathize with and have the most experience with the software engineering industry. One thing I cannot ignore is the best, most impactful and brightest software engineers I've ever worked with did not have college degrees. And of them, maybe 2/3 of them had high school diplomas. And I can't ignore that. And I also can't say it's just a couple people. There's a sample size of, say, a dozen that fit into that category across the hundreds of software engineers I've worked with over the span of my career.
My last question to help me get better at this process, is there a question I didn't ask that I should have, or something you wanted to say but haven't?
And I haven't fully vetted this thought, but one that I think people should consider. You don't ignore what you're good at. And those aren't necessarily, that's not necessarily the thing you love. You may be very good at something, but you don't like doing it. Don't ignore that. I'm not suggesting that you just because you're good at something, you may hate it and you should do that all of your life. Not suggesting that for a moment. And at the end of the day, I would err on the side of make sure you're doing what you love. But don't ignore what you're good at. I think you can find a wonderful balance between the two. And does that mean you're compromising some on what you love? Maybe. Does that mean you're compromising some on what you're good at, doing something just because you love it, but you might not be the best at it? Sure. But doing just what you love, I love to mountain bike. I would be mountain biking 4 to 6 hours every single day of my life if I was just doing that. But that's not sustainable. I don't think it's practical. So I employ things that I think I'm good at, and try to blend all that stuff together.
I want to thank Judd Valesky for joining me today. Thanks, Judd. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. That was quite enjoyable. Thanks a lot.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.